You're listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. It's helpful to know a little bit about Joseph O'Neill's family background. He's the son of an Irish father and a Turkish mother. He was born in Cork, Ireland, and grew up in the Netherlands, Mozambique, South Africa, Iran, Turkey. He was for many years a lawyer in London and now lives a full-time writer in Manhattan. Suffice it to say, there are many streams of influence in the man. The book he'll discuss tonight, Blood Dark Track, was originally published in the United States in 2001. It was a New York Times notable book, but after the events of September 11th, it passed under the public radar. Then his third novel, Netherland, appeared to enormous praise. Dwight Garner in the New York Times Book Review called it, quote, the wittiest, angriest, most exacting, and most desolate work of fiction we've yet had about life in New York and London after the World Trade Center fell. And by the time President Obama, you probably remember the video feed of him carrying around the paperback of Netherland shortly after he became president, Joseph O'Neill became a literary celebrity. Netherland won the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction and the Carey Group Irish Fiction Award. Blood Dark Track definitely deserves a second chance. It's a stunning book, an excavation into the past and its bearing on the present. Every family, every country has its secret. Blood Dark Track, wrote one critic, is about realizing that the secrets of the past suit the remorse of the day. Both of O'Neill's grandfathers, one Irish, one Turkish, ended up being imprisoned by the British in the 1940s. And as he investigates what happened in, quote, as he puts it, obscure, sometimes frightful parishes of Irish and Middle Eastern history, he demonstrates remarkable skills of synthesis as well as damn sheer doggedness as he digging for answers until the last interrogation of the last reluctant relative. It's really an extraordinary book. In conversation with Joseph tonight, we're very honored to have David Kippen, who is a book critic, an author, a translator, the former literature director of the National Endowment of the Arts, where he directed the Big Read and the Guadalajara Book Fair. We're very happy to have him back here in the LA community. In July of 2010, he opened a lending used library bookstore in the Jewish-turned-Latino neighborhood of Boyle Heights called Libros Schmibros. And you haven't lived until you've been to Libros Schmibros, so check it out. You can talk to David about it afterwards. So please join me in welcoming David Kippen and Joseph O'Neill.
We sort of agreed it might be a good idea to start with a reading from Mr. O'Neill's, sort of new and sort of old book, which we can talk about in a minute. But if you want to rev it up, let's hear a page or two.
Thank you, Louise, for those remarks. Blood Dark Track, published in 2001. The prologue, I'm just going to read the very opening of the book, and I'll start with the epigraph, which is written by Tom Barry, a famous figure in Irish Republican history, who wrote a book called Guerrilla Days in Ireland. Tom Barry was from West Cork, like my family. For me, it began in far-off Mesopotamia, now called Iraq, that land of biblical names and history, of vast deserts and date groves, scorching suns and hot winds, the land of Babylon, Baghdad, and the Garden of Eden, where the rushing Euphrates and the mighty Tigris converge and flow down into the Persian Gulf. It was there, in that land of the Arabs, then a battleground for the contending imperialistic armies of Britain and Turkey, that I awoke to the echoes of guns being fired in the capital of my own country, Ireland. End of epigraph. At some point in my childhood, perhaps when I was age 10 or 11, I became aware that during the Second World War, my Turkish grandfather, my mother's father, Joseph Dakad, had been imprisoned by the British in Palestine, a place exotically absent from any atlas. A shiver of an explanation accompanied this information. The detention had something to do with spying for the Germans. At around the same age, I also learned that my Irish grandfather, James O'Neill, had been jailed by the authorities in Ireland in the course of the same war. Nobody explained precisely why or where or for how long, and I attributed his incarceration to the circumstances of a bygone Ireland and a bygone IRA. These matters went largely unmentioned, and certainly undiscussed, by my parents in the 2 decades that followed. Indeed, the subject of my late grandfather's was barely raised at all, and save for a wedding day picture of Joseph, that's my Turkish grandfather, and his wife Georgette, there were no photographs of them displayed in our home. Dwelling in the jurisdiction of parental silence, my grandfather's remained mute and out of mind. Partially as a consequence of this, it was not until I was 30 that the curious parallelism in my grandfather's lives struck me with any force, and that I was driven to explore it, to fiddle at doors that had remained opened, perhaps even locked, for so many years, and not until then that I began to make out what connected these two men and these two captivities, one in the Levant heat, the other in the rainy, sporadically incandescent plains of Central Ireland. As will soon become apparent, I wasn't bringing a reflective political mind to bear on my grandfather's lives or any expertise as a historian, or even any abnormal inclination to wonder about what might lie behind a closed door. In general, I'm as content as the next man to proceed on the footing that any information of importance, anything that has a bearing on my essential interests, will be brought to my attention by those entrusted with such things: families, schools, news agencies, subversives. This is so even though the information I have on most historical and political subjects could be written out on a luggage tag, is almost certainly wrong, and at bottom probably functions as a political soporific, which perhaps explains why the insights I gained into my grandfather's lives often took the form of a slow, idiotic awakening. It took anomalous forces, a writer's professional curiosity turned into something like an obsession, to push me, reluctant and red-eyed and stumbling, into the past, and it turned out its dream-bright horrors. 2 inklings set me on my way, one for each grandfather. My Turkish grandfather, Mami Dekad, Mami being French for granny, my Turkish relations spoke French. All will be explained, I think, had an extreme attachment to a set of keys. She clung to them from morning till night, and then secreting them under her pillow. I actually prefer secreting them. Secreting them under her pillow from night till morning. When she mislaid them, all hell broke loose in multiple languages. She would shriek first at herself in Arabic, "Yi!" Next at her family in French, "Où sont mes clés?" And finally, with terrifying loudness and venom, at the nearest servant in Turkish, "Anahtarlar nerede?" The loss of keys was not the only thing that would set her off. My grandmother yelled frequently and for a whole variety of reasons at the waiters, maids, managers, cleaners and cooks whom she employed to staff her hotel and to attend to her personal needs and the needs of her family. All day they scurried in and out of her apartment in a sweat, delivering panniers of toast, bars of goat's cheese, lamb cutlets, fish, aubergines, meat pancakes, melons, watermelons, water, glasses of lemonade, bottles of FS beer, sodas, Coca-Colas, Turkish coffees, Turkish teas. You could never have enough to drink. Mersin, the port in southeast Turkey where my grandmother lived, is as humid a spot as you'll find in the Mediterranean, and in August, when my parents and their 4 children arrived for their annual holiday, my grandmother's breezeless apartment on the top floor of the hotel was as hot as a hammam. Fans vainly circulated warm air, and the trickle of coolness produced by the grinding air conditioning machine escaped ineffectually through the windows toward the harbour, where Turkish warships sat on the still water like cakes on a salver. When we were not immobilized on the divans, pooped out, stunned, minimizing our movements, we were opening one of the refrigerators. The doors, tall as ourselves, swung out with a gasping, rubbery suck. And taking long burning slugs of the freezing water that filled the Johnny Walker and Glenfiddich bottles jammed in the rack. My grandmother's outbursts were all the more terrible for their suddenness and unfairness. The minor domestic boo-boos, if any, from which they sprang, a fork misplaced in a drawer filled with Christopher silver, a floor-mopping delinquency, shockingly disproportionate to the condemnation that followed. I have never really understood why she was prone to these authoritarian rages. She was loving and unstinting with her friends and family, and, it so happens, a loyal employer. Perhaps the heat played a part, and racial and class contempt. Thank you.
Thank you very much for reading that. I'm glad you took it through to that account of your grandmother. Thank you all for coming tonight. It's a great passage to start with, I think, because you know you've got the mystery of the keys, and it lures people into a story that might otherwise prove challenging for folks. And it's something that I think is, I hope, worth asking: how much knowledge on the part of a reader can you take for granted nowadays, or could you take when you wrote this book 10, 12 years ago, about World War II, let alone the Armenian Genocide, the Easter Rising? How did you gauge how much to impart, how much backstory you had to provide?
Well, I mean, I thought a fair starting point was my own ignorance. Can you hear me now? Yeah, I thought a fair starting point was my own ignorance, so that if I didn't know something about something, or thought I knew something about something, but in fact didn't, then I probably had better write about it. It is amazing, actually, how you drift around in a state of sort of semi-knowledge about so many things, and how if pushed to volunteer something specifically factual about practically anything, you struggle. And for me, one of the great joys of this book was that although I was, in the first instance, looking into the family, the history and details of my family, sticking to my family members, were all these gobbets of history. And sticking to those gobbets were other gobbets. And it turned out that the more I went into it, the more I realized that, you know, the family history, and I imagine this is the same of any family, is essentially a tunnel into a more, you know, the more general history.
I think it's fair to say your family's tunnel has a few more forkings of the road than most people's. Was it challenging to structure a book with so many gobbets leading to other gobbets and the potential for confusion?
You know, I just realized I'm not even sure what a gobbet is. You see, that's what I mean. You know, we think we know stuff, but we don't. The book was immensely difficult to structure because you had to be faithful to the two things which are often in conflict. On the one hand, the facts, and and the way in which they materialize, and on the other hand, the requirement that you should produce a text which is capable of being read without being too agonizing. And in the end, and it's also like writing a gigantic piece of expository journalism as well. And there's just so much to explain and so much to get into. And in the end, I realized that the way to structure it was to just follow, was to have me as a kind of character, not as a protagonist, and to follow my my investigations. And I took actually very few liberties. I might have compressed one or two incidents to make it, to get to the gist of it more quickly. And in the end, the structure is, I realized, almost retrospectively, that the first act, it's a three-act structure. The first act is the received stories about the family. Then the next act is the counter-stories, the counter-narratives generated by my investigations. And finally, a synthetic, hopefully, new and sort of growing narrative at the end.
I wouldn't worry too much on that score. How important was it to visit, or in some cases revisit, the actual sites where a lot of these events took place?
Well, I mean, for example, my Turkish grandfather was imprisoned in Palestine and in numerous places, but most lengthily in a place called Emmaus, which surfaces in the Bible somewhere and in the New Testament. And on the one hand, it's not that important. I mean, if you're focusing on the political and moral significance and the historical significance of what he went through. And I knew from my grandfather produced a document which I discovered in the attic of my grandmother's house, and it described his arrest and imprisonment at the hands of the British, which lasted for 4 or 5 years. And he also described essentially his torture and his suicide attempts and so forth while he was in jail. And again, jail is the wrong word, but in an internment camp. And so I managed to track down the house in which he'd been held captive for the last 2 or 3 years. And it was a building occupied by a religious order. And it's just a kind of... I think I felt a very personal, I felt moved to be there. But there's something problematic, basically, about trying to extract too much information from this kind of encounter. You realize that that every scrap of land has different meanings attached to it, and there's essentially a competition of meaning attaching to practically everything.
How did you come to persuade yourself that your own life was memoir worthy? I mean, it seems obvious now, you've written this terrific book about it and such wonderful, sensational things and terrible things happened. But I mean, it must be, you had written a novel or two by the time
you
wrote this?
Yeah, two novels.
And are those in print, I meant to ask?
I fear they might be.
Because I went looking and didn't have much luck. Dissuade us from seeking them out?
I think they're, I don't want to sort of just keep, if everybody would keep this to themselves. Entre nous, they're, I think, available in England, on Amazon. So, anyway. It wasn't really my story. It was my grandfather's story. And I'm just a humble water carrier of history. You know, I just trundle around collecting the dripping information and trying to make something of it. So I personally have had a very unexceptional sort of life. And in fact, that's almost the starting point for this book, which is that it was written, as I said, 10, 15 years ago when I was a lawyer and I had good fortune not to have been tested by history and in the way that my grandfather's had been. And, one of the great irony, and so as I continued to write this book, I became aware that essentially it's a book which ultimately dwells on the question of the relationship between the individual conscience and the forces of history as they occur. And, of course, I was in the position of having an individual conscience which had never been tested by the forces of history. And so the book ended on that note, and also on the note that maybe one day it would be, and that maybe one day our grandchildren would look back on our lives and say, is with us still.
Are you the first writer in your family?
Yes.
What was it like going back and reading your grandfather's words? Not a writer, but, I mean...
Well, he wrote it in Turkish, so I find it hard to judge his prose style. And what I actually ended up reading was my aunt's translation of it into French. And... I have to say, it could spare some editing. And it's particularly because he became, he wrote it, I think, immediately after he returned from, you know, these years of isolation and extreme distress. And it was written, I, as I understand it, in order to notify the Turkish authorities, the authorities of his homeland, of what had happened to him and how he'd been treated. And I think in the end he never did anything with it. He was advised not to do it. And so there are, he's still very much in a state of paranoia and agitation when he's writing this. And later on, I think, as I understand it, he became much... he managed to put the whole thing behind him, more or less.
And your other grandfather, your Irish grandfather, is also interned in the course of this. But what's the distinction in your mind between imprisonment and internment? Because it seems important.
Well, imprisonment suggests some sort of legal process and prison sentence, whereas internment just suggests being, you know, being removed from and being put away, locked away, without any access to, you know, without any reason, basically.
Do you think your grandfathers would have gotten on together, these two internees, had they met?
Most unlikely. I mean, they might have bonded on a sort of animosity towards the British.
Yeah. that was the interning agent in both cases.
Yeah. Well, no. My Irish grandfather, let's not forget, was actually interned by the Irish authorities, and who were worried at the beginning of the Second World War that the IRA men would cause trouble and would jeopardize Ireland's neutral status in the war. And one of the things I discovered was that in 1939, there was a very violent a campaign of political violence in Britain, and that my grandmother's brothers effectively were very significant actors in all of that, and so that they didn't want any repetition of that sort of thing, and so they locked them away in a place called the Curragh, which is a military camp.
Which you also visited.
Which I did visit, yeah. Horrible, kind of horrible, soulless sort of place.
This is a very thoughtful book, I think, about violence. And most of us mercifully don't have the opportunity to find out how we would behave under violent circumstances. Do you feel as if you have the potential for violence within you? Or?
Well, I mean, I suppose I do, yes. I think so. I think it depends. I mean, the thing about political violence, I mean, look, I think, you know, everyone here is an agent of political violence because the United States government has, you know, been responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths in the last 10 years. And presumably they do so authorized by the political system of which we are part. Yeah, however much we might disagree with any particular aspect of that campaign, it might be justified or not, but it's happened. And so there isn't a kind of there isn't a sort of clear distinction. You know, that we are implicated. And you know, well, the interesting thing about my two grandfathers is how different they were. You ask whether they've got along or not. My Irish grandfather really believed in, you know, the power of the individual to intervene in history, I mean, and to do something about what was going on. That's the, you know, you don't join the IRA unless you believe that you can make change happen. Whereas my Turkish grandfather was an extremist of another kind. He was an extreme bystander. And he really believed that, I mean, the reason he got arrested in Palestine was because he went there in order to buy 200 tons of lemons. And he wanted, he then excited the attentions of the Secret Service, the British Secret Service. He had already done that because he was a Germanophile. He ran a hotel. I mean, he looked like he might be up to something.
There's a great couple of pages toward the end of the book where you actually discuss whether violence, political violence, works, and or can work, and the conclusion that you come to, although you qualify it, is that the violence, at least the violence in Ireland, had in fact been, and you use a what to my ear sounds like a legal word, efficacious. Talk about that a little bit, how the IRA and their campaign of violence did or didn't bring about the goals that for which it was intended.
Well, I mean, this is a very complicated question. I mean, first of all, I to make a more general statement, people who belong to organizations like the IRA don't arrive there after sort of careful considerations. I learned that my father was in the IRA, and it was not atypical that, and only briefly, I hasten to add.
Which you find out in the course of the book.
Which I find out in the course of, he told me about that. And, they join when they're teenagers, and they do so as a kind of tribal thing, and they have very, very powerful narratives in the air, and they take it upon themselves to join that movement. But on the question of political violence and how we think about it, I mean, I happen to believe that there are very kind of sensible and, philosophical analyses of when violence is ethically okay and when it isn't, and when war is ethically okay and when it isn't. I mean, there's a large measure of agreement about such issues. And one of the things which everyone is agreed upon is that there's almost no point in perpetrating political violence if it's going to be ineffective. I mean, why? You're just killing people for no reason. Of course, then there's a huge debate at what it means, efficacy means in this context. But I think, although I myself am ultimately opposed to the use of political violence as of the IRA, the one thing which is difficult to argue with is that the current state of affairs, which more or less does justice to both communities in the north of Ireland, would have come about without some form of extreme action. There's no way that the majority, the powerful unionist majority, would have voluntarily surrendered its advantages. It had to be forced to do that. And then, of course, the question becomes, what is were there alternatives way of doing this? And I actually think that had they exhausted all remedies before they had turned to violence? I think the answer to that is no. They could have. I mean, we have examples from Martin Luther King to Gandhi, etc., that there are extremely effective ways of bringing about political change which don't involve killing people.
You come at these questions not just as a writer, but as a former lawyer, not practicing currently, are you?
I hope not.
I'm curious. How recently did you devote yourself full time to writing?
About 9 years ago. About 8 years ago. 2002 was my last case.
So after Netherlands?
Before Netherlands.
Well before. Okay. I wonder if you'd talk a bit about the different registers in which writers and lawyers work. Do you hear, I mean, the law is, I guess, famously...
pompous?
When you came home after a day at the bar to...
I was unbearable. I still am, though, but just in a writerly sort of way.
Do you catch yourself lapsing into the old legalese and have to say, no, I put that behind me? Or...
I like legalese.
Really?
I do, yeah. I mean... I was a barrister, which means I had the sort of wig and gown on, and I was doing my thing in court. And, the mark of an extremely... The better the advocate, the more simple everything is. And it sounds like a 15-year-old has written it. Because you're not afraid of simplifying things, because you understand them. Of course, if you don't understand things, then you become slightly more eloquent. The important thing I learned and sort of treasure is the idea of ideas having a meaning. For example, intellectual honesty. So, for example, like when the Iraq War started, before the Iraq War, there was the question was, should we invade Iraq? Not simply as a pragmatic matter, but as a matter of right and wrong. I mean, and it seemed to me that there was just no way you could start. I mean, you either abandon international law, because it was obviously illegal because he didn't have Security Council approval under international law. And so it was obviously a war of aggression, which is not permitted by international law. And so all these debates about this, that, and the other, didn't, as far as I was concerned, I didn't even get into that. The war was obviously illegal, and unless you believe that international law is it can be dispensed with, which I don't, it's just wrong. And then of course we learned afterwards all the other reasons why it was problematic.
How prominent in your thinking were these questions of geopolitics when you sat down to write what has become, I think, alongside maybe Ken Kalfas's book, whose name slips my mind just at the moment, but I mean, you know, what has generally come to be regarded as, you know, one of the best, if not the best, fictional attempts to grapple with the legacy of those events.
Well, I mean, I'm glad you I'm not sure that judgment is actually right, but I think you flatter me. It's a very different business, writing a novel. You know, you're not too worried about, you're not banging any particular drum, except for the drum of the artistic one, which is trying to do justice to the form you're writing in. So that my narrator, for example, in Netherlands, is a very conservative guy who doesn't seem particularly switched on to the political ins and outs of what's going on around him, although these other people drift into his purview. And so you're getting at something very, very different, and you're approaching it in a very different way. I mean, I find that his wife is much more up my alley politically. It's just a very, very different, much dreamier and intuitive business than this, which is quite, which, I mean, this book is partially about the business of rationality. Well, I mean, when people write, think about their families, they think about this, whether they who got upset and who loved who and what happened then and what they had for breakfast, and there are ways of, you know, it's like the way people think about politicians here. I like his suits, or you know, she's got a horrible voice, and this kind of stuff. And and so this book tries to be conscientious. And my idea of conscientiousness is about trying to be rational. I mean, it's obviously, it's possibly a forlorn hope, but one has to be. I try to be as, thoughtful and dispassionately consistent as possible, and therefore there's the rather dogged book, as was mentioned earlier.
Once the book was complete, how did this rooting around in family history go over with the family at holidays?
They went down surprisingly well. Mm-hmm. I mean, to the extent that they read it. I wouldn't be at all surprised if many of them just steered away from it, simply out of, and rightly so. Why should they read it, really? But I was surprised. People disagreed with what I'd written, but no one. This is what gives me a lot of satisfaction. No one said to me that I'd misrepresented anybody or anything.
And how was it for you revisiting it? I mean, you've, I guess, have the pleasure, thanks to the deserved success of Netherland, of seeing this book find a broader audience now than it did the first time around. Did you go back and read it after an interval of 10 years, and did it
No.
seem to be the book you'd turned your back on? No?
I dipped into it. I dipped into it. The sort of bits I remembered, but I quite liked. Not that many. It wasn't a very short exercise. And I dipped into it. And, this book is still in me. It's still current. Whereas, for example, the first two novels I wrote, who wrote those? I have no idea. What's in them? I don't know. But this book, it does feel as if it's still, mine.
Just to give you an idea of how things will go, we'll talk for another, 5-10 minutes or so, and then open it up to you folks so that it can be a rather broader conversation. you are, thanks to your parents' marriage, this, among other things, this confluence of interesting heritages. Do you know other...
Well, technically, I'm not sure it's their marriage that did it.
Well, no, I guess perhaps not strictly speaking, but...
Sorry.
Do you know other Irish Turks or Turkish Irish? And do they
actually? Funny enough, when you're Irish Turkish, you start to notice other Irish Turks.
I would imagine.
And you know, it doesn't happen very often, but somehow or other, sometimes you run into another one. Usually, it's different. It's the other way around. It's usually it's the father. It's the male who's Turkish, and the female who's Irish. Because I think, why would that be? I know why that. I think, well, it's because, first of all, I don't think many Turkish women would feel authorized to marry an Irishman because, on account of their Muslim religion.
My mother
belonged to this tiny French-speaking Syrian, Turkish minority of Syrian origins, and they spoke French, and they were, you know, Catholics, and so... You know, there was no religious conflict there. In fact, there was an identity of religion.
Hmm. Well, I mean, I guess, you know, as the world becomes, you know, more polyglot and we get to know each other better, although, you know, with occasional flare-ups, there will be, you know, more and more, not just, you know, races, but combinations of races. I mean, do you find when you pay attention to the you know, the few other Turkish Irish or Irish Turks out there that there are common personality traits to them, as we now think, rightly or wrongly, of traits from either heritage?
I mean, do they drink heavily?
Comes to mind.
No, I just think that, you know, it is a novelty that you have an Irish-Turkish combination. But on the other hand, as you rightly point out, it's far less of a novelty now than it used to be. Mm. And I'm sure there are the Irish and Turks, as we speak, are mingling in numbers that never happened before. And so that I do actually think, though, that my family was a kind of almost a prototype for a kind of for a phenomenon which is now becoming much more widespread.
How do you think you would cope with, if not imprisonment, then internment?
I would go mad. Because, I mean, you have no recourse. It's like that's why everyone in Guantanamo Bay is trying to kill themselves, because I don't think it's the experience of being incarcerated. It's just the lack of there's no light at the end of the tunnel. You have no access to lawyers, you have no access to a legal system, and you are absolutely unseen. And it's a recipe for going mad, as far as I can tell.
What personal reserves do you think your grandfathers fell back on not to go mad?
Well, my Turkish one pretty much did. And although, you know, it was a temporary state of affairs.
Yeah, exactly.
As my Irish grandfather, I think, was helped by the fact that he was interned with hundreds of others. Yeah. And so there was a bit of solidarity which kept them going. But it was no picnic.
Well, like I say, I reserve the right to jump in with a question or two as things go on, but maybe folks in the audience have questions up their sleeves that they'd want to throw out, and probably I should repeat them as... or there's a microphone going around, so I'll spare you that, but yes.
Hold on one, and then maybe the next one we can...
Sounds terrific. This gentleman down here, if we could hear from him. Here comes the microphone, so bear with us for just a sec.
The two novels under discussion you described as one being rational, the other inspirational or intuitive. What's next, rational or intuitive?
I'm not sure. I want to write an intuitive knowledge about rationality. I'm actually serious about that. Among other things, the whole question of trying to think your way through things and how problematic that is, how difficult that is. I mean, who of us can really do it? And yet we keep trying, and what other options do we have? So there's my answer to your question.
Yeah, there's another one, and I'll throw one out in the meanwhile. Netherland is commonly thought to be to owe a certain debt, though not a huge one, to the Great Gatsby. How do you feel about that? It must be a rather daunting mantle to wear. And also, did you have another model or two when you undertook Blood Dark Track?
Well, there weren't. One of the problems of writing this book is that I didn't find any models at all. Mm. I mean, most people write memoirs about their own memories of family, and I had no memories of these men. And or they write vaguely, you know, stuff about their childhood. And again, so it was writing. So I didn't have. I mean, I'm sure there are models out there, but I didn't run across them. And Gatsby, well, yeah. I mean, it's. I have a sort of phrase I just utter in relation to Gatsby, which is. Becomes increasingly less meaningful every time I utter it, which is that my novel was in a conversation with Gatsby. I'm not sure what that means, but it sort of gets me off the hook, I hope.
Well, if no other questions come up about
and,
it...
And of course, my book, of course, is the junior interlocutor in that conversation.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you think or have you thought about the fact that this injustice or... internment of both of your grandfathers had something to do with you becoming a lawyer in the first place. The legacy of, you know, being incarcerated without you. A couple times you said with no access to a lawyer. I just wondered if there was a.
That's a very, if I may respectfully say so, a thoughtful question. I don't think so, and I think becoming a lawyer made me more acutely aware of them. Rather than the other way around, because you understand as a lawyer what it means to how justice, have a better understanding of how justice ought to work. Now, I think I became a lawyer because I was the first O'Neill to go to college, and it was seen as a great thing to be a lawyer if I could somehow manage it, and I did, and I enjoyed it. I sort of took to it up to a point, obviously.
Over there, Louise.
Joseph, I was so struck when you were exploring your Turkish grant with Joseph's background and what he went through. You came to the conclusion of that he saw the genocide of the Armenians, or he saw these things taking place, and he didn't ever talk about it. It's so interesting to uncover what someone saw but didn't ever say. Can you talk a little bit about his bystander position, or how you came to the conclusion of that explained to, in your mind, his silence?
We're talking about 1915, and my grandfather was 16 years old, and in Aleppo, and at the time. And there are all these accounts in the records of the arrival in Aleppo of what remained of the Armenians. And there's no doubt that that my grandfather would have been, could not but have noticed this. And not just him, his whole community were aware of, ought to have been aware of what was going on because it happened to their neighbours. Although that particular town where my family was located didn't have that many Armenians, and the question in my mind was why. I asked my Turkish family, well, why didn't you why did I not do something? There's nothing they could do about it because they themselves are a very vulnerable minority. But why not at least notice it? And, I got from two entirely different people, I got the same response. On ne les fréquentait pas. We didn't frequent them. And it's, it's an insight into the Ottoman Empire, specifically, which is to say that on the one hand, it's a very kind of mixed bag of ethnic and religious groups living side by side. In relative autonomy, but on the other hand, that coexistence depends on blindness, simply not seeing the other, and so it's a question of, and that's an enormous kind of political and moral question: is Where do you begin to see and where do you end to see? Should we see, for example, in a war, you don't see the victims. We decide that they're just the enemy. We don't see them. But if somebody runs over one's cat, we get very upset by it because we see it and we choose to see it.
And theoretically, I guess, you know, satellite television enables distant wars to reach us with the immediacy of our cat, but it doesn't always work.
Well, I just think it's, you know, I think it's a very, very problematic position we're put into now. We have access to all kinds of information and spectacles, and it's actually a source of anguish, I think, to many people that they are confronted with suffering and injustice and demands on their conscience, you know, constantly. And it's the question, I suppose, now is how do we navigate this and how do we, what is our hierarchy of seeing and feeling?
Joseph Conrad is quoted as saying, any work that pretends to the condition of art must bear its justification in every line. Are you less troubled by that caveat when writing journalistically as compared to that of a novel?
That's a very interesting question. You know, there's no doubt that when you're writing, first of all, journalistically is not a word I would necessarily associate with this book, simply because my humble hope is that, unlike journalism, it will sort of stick around a little bit, be capable of being read after it's been written, after a certain amount of time has passed. But I think when I was writing this, I was enough of a novelist to do my best, given that it was a lot of factual exposition was involved, to write it in accordance with, you know, what I hoped were artistic considerations. But on the other hand, I became interested in the question of factuality and as an artistic merit. You know, so if you're writing rather factually about something and you're obviously not writing about it in a different way, you're actually, among other things, asking a question about whether or not it's kind of artistically valid to rein in certain priorities and to put these at the forefront. And I think the unifying thing between nonfiction and fiction for the writer is that you must write conscientiously as you possibly can. And it's just that the demands of the conscience are different in the question of nonfiction than what they are in fiction.
Since we brought it up, I didn't want to let the evening go by without asking about the nonfiction that you write about fiction, the criticism that you've done, I think, primarily in the Atlantic. How do you approach that work? I mean, you're damned good at it. Do you approach it as a novelist? I mean, or do you read differently and approach a critical essay differently, you know, in conversation with the work under review? Or are you at heart a reader rather than a novelist when you read something?
Well, just people, you know, who don't read The Atlantic, there might be one or two of you who don't. I do occasionally write something for The Atlantic, and it's a great kind of privilege to do that. And but my work only appears once or twice a year at the moment, and partly because I try to write a substantial essay about a particular writer, and I do my best with it. That's all I can say. I try to read as much as I can and think about it as much as I can, and try and say something of interest. And I just think it's a question of doing your best. That's all. That's all you can do, really.
I'll take your best over just about anybody else's. Was there another question out here? There were. Only one? Oh.
Hi. This isn't necessarily a fair question, but I'm sitting here very confused because I didn't
ever hear you speak or anything, and so I always thought of you with your surname as an Irish writer. And yet, now you're Turkish-Irish, however you sound British. So I'm very confused. And maybe I'll get the answer from reading this book, but how do you identify yourself? What do you identify with personally? What background or nationality or whatever?
I sort of identify with all of it. And I'm sort of increasingly less interested in the sort of, the idea of one nationality. It just doesn't seem to me to be accurate or meaningful. The meaning of being American or being Irish just changed so much. Because the content of nationality and of a national culture is so up for grabs these days. And so I have two passports, and I think I would happily have two or three more. I sort of feel the sort of simultaneity of nationality is kind of corresponds to my sense of how things are, how my life is. And also I do have an English accent. And I do. But that's because I went to an English school and then went to England.
Is that wonderful moment in Blood, Dark, Crack where you're inquiring into your grandfather's past, and yet you realize that by virtue of how you sound, you may be regarded as an outsider?
Yeah, I know. I mean, I went to, because of my family, I had access to all kinds of IRA guys, and it did seem very strange to say hello. But the weird thing is that I was completely accepted. That's the weird thing, because of, the people introducing me.
Do you think we're losing something while we're gaining a more heterogeneous experience of the world? I mean, do you mourn the loss a little bit of, very rural Ireland and pockets and thick accents that are gradually becoming watered down? Is that something that seems a drawback to what otherwise I suppose we'd think is a welcome development?
Well, I mean, I think we're always in a constant state of trauma about all changes that go on. I mean, any kind of change, even a change for the better, is basically traumatic. And yes, it does seem pretty bad in some senses. You do definitely mourn. And I take the case of Ireland. Ireland has changed dramatically in the last 15 years. It just went like that, and people in Ireland do feel that they've lost something, undoubtedly. But I actually think that the big loss in the last 20, 30 years is the loss of fauna. That's the one I think is unthinkable.
Animals.
Really? I think that the near eradication of practically every significant species is something which I just don't know how to talk about it or how to explain it to my children, that they're going to grow up in a world where there are a handful of cheetahs left and where there are practically no tigers. I mean, and not to mention all the other, all the other things. So that although the history of humanity is one of kind of constant turmoil and injustice, unsatisfactory, at least until now we hadn't wiped out the animals. But this is what we seem to be in the process of doing. And I'm not particularly sort of, it's not something that detains me very much, but it just strikes me as being the one irrevocable change which is taking place now.
You speak of your children. This is such a grandson's book. Do you think when, with or without you handy, your grandchildren get around to reading it, do you think your life will be as mysterious to them as your grandparents is to you? Or because, we live in a much more recorded environment, you'll seem, less of a question mark?
Well, they'll be able to Google their grandparents. If Google is still around, they'll be able to sort of, I suppose they'll be able to download these books on the grandchildren of the Kindle. I just don't think people are that interested in their grandparents. I took an exceptional interest in them. And I think the very rarity of the inquiry meant that I got a good response from people because they don't normally get to talk about this stuff. Mm. But most of us are happy to kind of look ahead, look around, think ahead. and just, you see, again, we have enough on our plate without thinking too much about the past.
You're such a writer of place. I mean, this book is so suffused with Ireland and Mersin, and your novel is such a Valentine to New York, although not a qualified one, certainly. I'm wondering if, unless you're superstitious about these things, what you're working on now and where it's set?
Well, since you ask. Yes, the place. Pretty much the only thing I know about our next novel is that it will be set in Dubai.
Really? What an interesting place, because it's. No, I mean it.
Glad you're
saying
that.
No.
It's very polite of you.
No. I'll cop to that. You know, a couple of years ago, I thought, well, if I were a cynical guy and I wanted to write a thriller that sells like blazes, I would set it in Dubai, because it's this fascinating place where all this money is flowing in. And yet within the last couple of years, it seems interesting in different ways. It's not anymore this gold rush that we'd been led to expect. When did you conceive the idea to work on this thing? Let's just ahead to our conversation.
I'm reluctant to discuss my next book when I haven't written a word of it.
Well,
I do think that would jinx it, actually. I know, in all seriousness, I think it's actually a little counterproductive and inhibiting to skip the writing phase and go straight to the...
But it's so much more efficient.
Self-congratulatory, and yes, what a fascinating... Yes, I know, it is efficient, that's what I... Perhaps you seem to have done that.
And it's working for
me. You're doing very well out of it.
This is terrific. Well, in lieu of that conversation, and in anticipation of that conversation, which I hope we can have on a stage, this one or one like it, what are the questions in? All right, then. Well, I've enjoyed this thoroughly, and I dare say the audience has too, and if they'd want to give you one last round of thanks before we head out to the signing area, that'd be terrific.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.